Thing we are especially glad to have you in our midst. Among our visitors tonight is Ryan and Connie. We're glad to have them with us. It's at least most of the time, it's a surprise, but it's always a pleasant surprise to have them here. In our lesson tonight, I thought that it would be really good as I thought about what I wanted to do tonight. I came across this lesson, which I think will be a very appropriate companion lesson to our study this morning on the subject of the sin of fornication. And the lesson tonight, how Joseph maintained his integrity. How Joseph maintained his integrity, or how Joseph remained true to the standards that he himself held. So I want to begin by just reminding us of the story here in Genesis 37 and 39. Joseph, of course, was Jacob's favorite son, and Joseph received some dreams from God. These dreams were sent to him by God, and thus he was inspired to see the things that he did see. He dreamed that he and his brothers were out in the field gathering grain, and as they cut the grain, gathering the armfuls, they would make these armfuls eventually into bundles called sheaves. And then they would tie these together and sit them up, or sometimes they'd just lay them down to be collected later. Their sheaves, the sheaves of all of his brothers, bowed down to his sheaf, and he told them about that. Now, there's nothing in the story to indicate that Joseph was telling them that to sort of poke fun at them or anything. That it really aggravates me when we start injecting all sorts of negative characteristics into Joseph, when the Bible doesn't give Joseph any negative characteristics. He had received a divinely inspired dream, and he told his brothers about it. And when he received another, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed down to Joseph. And he not only told his brethren, but he told his father. And his father was wondering, "Son, do you think this means that your mother and I and your brethren will bow down to you?" Well, Joseph didn't know what it meant any more than anybody else did. But he was telling them about these dreams because they were impressive to him, and he himself wondered what they meant. But the brothers were very jealous of Joseph, because they saw that he was the most favored son of his father. And the dreams did not help anything, because the dreams did seem to indicate that Joseph was going to be in a position of superiority over them someday. So all of these things conspired together to make Joseph hated in the eyes of his brethren. So the time came that they went back up to Shechem to check on the sheep and the flocks and so on of Jacob. And Jacob got to wondering how things were going. He really trusted Joseph. Joseph was one that Jacob felt he could absolutely depend upon to do what was the right thing and to tell the truth, whatever it was. So he sent him up there to check on the brothers. When he got up in the area of Shechem, checking around, he found they were gone, and he found a man in a field, and he said to the man, "Do you know where my brethren are gone?" And the man said, "I think they went over to Dothan. I understand they went over to Dothan." Now, Dothan was nearer the trade routes that went through the passes of near Megiddo and so on. And so it was nearer the trade routes where the caravans would pass through. And so Joseph went on over there. And as he approached, his brethren looked up and saw him coming. And they said, "Ah, it's the master of dreams coming." It was a satirical expression when they said, "Ah, it's the dream master." You can imagine the tone of their voice as they said that. And they were of a mind to kill Joseph. They hated him so badly. But Reuben said, "No, don't kill him. Look, there's a cistern, a dry hole in the ground here. Let's just put him down in there and abandon him." Reuben's plan was to come back later and get him out. But then Reuben went away for some reason or other, and while he was gone, there was a caravan of Midianites or Ishmaelites who came through. And as they were coming through, Judah had an idea. Judah said, "Why don't we sell Joseph?" And he said, "You know, that way we will not have actually killed him. After all, he is our brother. You know, You sort of feel like there's very scant brotherly love here. After all, he's our brother. Why don't we just sell him as a slave? And that way we won't have killed him, at least. So they did. They sold him to the Egyptians, ignoring his cries and everything. They sold him as a slave. Joseph was taken away from his family. 17 years old is how old he was. A lot of times we don't think of 17 as being an age when someone is terribly strong. But some of the most dedicated, finest people I've known have been 17. But, you know, until adversity comes, until trial comes, you can't tell what a person is made of a lot of times. And so here at 17, Joseph is thrown into the fiery furnace, as it were. He was taken to Egypt and sold to Potiphar as a slave. There is a tendency of people when they move away from home to forsake all that they've learned, to forsake the standards that they've learned. And apparently there is a tendency in that direction, maybe a temptation to do so. And so here Joseph is now a slave. A lot of times, people, it's easy to get feeling sorry for yourself and say, why me? And to blame God with what happened. You know, on the face of it, this would have been a good time for Joseph to blame God with what happened. He could have said, what have I done to deserve to be treated like this? God, why did you do this to me? But we don't see the slightest hint of that in Joseph's conduct. Instead, when he is given work in Potiphar's house, he does the work and he does it very well. And so as time goes along, he is given more and more responsibility until finally Potiphar is ignoring everything that goes on his estate because Joseph is such a good manager. Well, about this time, the old serpent enters the picture. You know, there's always something to spoil the Garden of Eden. Well, this wasn't exactly the Garden of Eden, but at least things were going along fairly well for Joseph. And then Potiphar's wife began to notice Joseph, that he was a nice-looking young man, and from all we know about him, I'm sure he was a pleasant young man, and she began to lust after Joseph. She wanted to commit fornication with Joseph. And she pressed him about this. And you know, when you're a slave and you're being pressed by the master's wife and so on, you can see how there could be some difficulties there. And as you think about what you feel like you ought to do and what might happen if you do what you ought to do, it would be a temptation to give in. And so she said to Joseph, lie with me. But he refused and said unto his master's wife, behold, my master knoweth not what is with me in the house, and he hath put all that he hath into my hand. He is not greater in this house than I. In other words, Joseph meant that Potiphar has so completely turned things over to me that I run the house just like he would if he were here. I tell everybody, I tell the other servants, I run things, I take care of things. Neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness? Now here's a key. We expect him to say, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against Potiphar when he's been so good to me and so trusting of me as to turn everything over to me? That's what you would expect. But instead he said, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And the key that this gives us is that as Joseph thought about things of right and wrong, he did not think about them in terms of convenience. He did not think about them merely in terms of the people that might be involved. He realized that when you sin, ultimately the one who is offended the most, and certainly the most serious one that is offended, is God. Well, this went on for a period of time. And Joseph began to be sure he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. And it came to pass about this time that he went into the house to do his work, and there was none of the men of the house there within. And she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out. It's interesting, we don't have one word of dialogue here. There wasn't any dialogue. She said, "Lie with me." He didn't even take time to say no. He just tore out of there. And for his trouble, he was thrown into prison. But he did what was right. He got in trouble at the time, but he didn't get in trouble with God. And that's what matters the most. There are many lessons for us to learn in this story, but what I want us to do is to examine how Joseph maintained his integrity. And to make the points I'm going to make, I'm going to refer to certain other characters in the Bible and statements that are made about them. And we can bring all of these statements together to bear in the story of Joseph and why he did not fall into sin here, how he maintained the standards that he had. First, Joseph made a covenant with his eyes. Now, for this point, let's look at Job chapter 31. Job chapter 31 and verse 1. In chapter 31 is where Job, at the close of the cycle of speeches with Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, this is where he is making the point, if I have done wrong in any way, then I am not at all refusing to take the chastisement or the punishment that the Lord has sent my way. Now, does everybody get that? Chapter 31, he just goes through a whole list of sins. And he says, if I have done any one of these sins, then I do not refuse to accept the punishment that I have been given. So as he begins his speech in this chapter, I made a covenant with mine eyes. How then should I look upon a virgin? Meaning, how then could I look upon a virgin to lust after her? I made a covenant with mine eyes. We need to form good habits. And this is what Job had done, and obviously what Joseph had done. Because this determination here results in a habit that is not merely a form, but a good habit. Some habits just happen, but not a habit that goes against the flow of nature. All of us probably do things now. Probably you tie your shoes the way you learned how before you learned how. In other words, you don't remember learning how to tie your shoes. But you probably still tie them the way you learned to, and you don't even remember learning how. And there are a lot of things like that that just happen. But here's a habit that goes against the flow of nature. There is within us the desire that can lead us to want things that God says, no, you cannot have this. A habit like this is formed intentionally. And that's the thing I want you to see in Job's case and in Joseph's case. This was a habit that was formed intentionally. And so when we form moral and spiritual habits, they are formed intentionally. This was a habit, a mode of behavior that was formed from principles. Job and Joseph both had this devotion to God and to His cause. They were committed to His principles, and therefore they made up their minds what they would and would not do. And this was the foundation of the good habits that they had. What Job put from himself was not only the act of fornication. You know, it's one thing to say, oh, I'm making up my mind, I'll not commit fornication. I'm going to draw the line there. No, he didn't draw the line there. He drew the line farther back. But even the indulgence of so much as a lascivious desire, Job made up his mind, I am not going to allow myself to have lascivious desire for a woman or a young lady. I'm not going to do that. I'm making up my mind, I will not permit myself to do that. So, in doing this, some of you may be already thinking that in doing this, Job anticipated the Sermon on the Mount. You remember that? It's interesting, isn't it? Job, probably 2,000 years before Jesus, And yet Job knew the principle that Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount when he said, "You have heard that it was said to them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that everyone that looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery already, or committed adultery with her already in his own heart." And so this action of Job anticipates the Sermon on the Mount, which forbids the unchaste look, the unclean imagination, the impure desire, as well as fornication itself. Job did not let his eyes run him. He controlled his eyes. Peter described certain false teachers as having eyes full of adultery and that cannot cease from sin. 2 Peter 2 and verse 14. Now here's the person who indulges himself, who enjoys what he's doing and goes on and does it and makes no effort to control his mind or his thoughts. But Job was master of his eyes instead of letting his eyes master him. It's interesting in the Bible how much sin enters by the eye. Consider Eve. Might want to look at these verses right quick as we go through. Just to be impressed with this. Genesis 3, verse 6. "And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food," now that was a mental perception through the eyes. But here's the part. "And that it was a delight to the eyes," that entered into the temptation that moved her to eat the forbidden fruit. In Genesis 13 and verse 10, in connection with Lot, the Bible says that when Abraham told him, "Is not the whole land before us? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou take the right hand, then I will go to the left." Now verse 10. "And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of the Jordan." And all he was doing was letting it register through his eyes. Boy, that is really some nice grass. And that is a well-watered plain. Oh, that would really be good for my flocks and herds. He was letting his eyes do the thinking and not really thinking with the spiritual part of his personality, of the consequences of the choice. Joshua chapter 7 and verse 21, during the taking of the city of Jericho, the Bible says, now here's the words of Achan, "When I saw among the spoil a goodly Babylonish mantle and 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight, then I coveted them." I saw them. I coveted them. Turn back then to Genesis 38 and verse 15. And this is a story about Judah. When Judah had lost his wife, verse 12 says, "In the process of time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. Some time went along. He went to his sheep shearers, to Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite." And verse 15 says that when Judah saw her, the one he saw was Tamar, his own daughter-in-law, to whom he was to give his son. And he didn't do it. So she went down there and disguised herself to look like a harlot. That is a Kadesha, a religious prostitute. And the Bible says, when Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot. That means that he looked, he saw the clothing. This is a Kadesha, a religious prostitute. And so then he followed up on that by going in unto her and committing incest with his own daughter-in-law, although he did not know that it was his daughter-in-law at the time. I'm sure it was a great source of shame to Judah when that did come out. Because what did happen was Tamar conceived as a result of this action of Judah's. And someone brought Judah word that your daughter-in-law Tamar is with child by harlotry. "Bring her out at once and we'll put her to death," Judah says. And so as they come to get her to bring her out, she said, "Well, this cord and this signet and so on, they belong to the man by whom I am with child." They brought it out and showed it to Judah, and I have often tried to imagine what his face looked like when he saw it, and everybody could know, because these were very personal items, everybody could know, these are Judah's. Judah did it. But he saw her, and he thought with his eyes and with his body instead of with his mind and his spirit. Samson. Judges chapter 16, verse 1. Samson went to Gaza and saw there a harlot, went in unto her. Instead of seeing her and saying, oh, that's a harlot, I'm getting out of here. He saw her and went in unto her. David beheld Bathsheba bathing, and he looked and he looked until he kindled his lust. Now, Matthew 18 and verse 9. Matthew 18, verse 9. If thine eye causeth thee to stumble, pluck it out and cast it from thee. It is good for thee to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into the hell of fire. Jesus was calling our bluff, you might say. Because what we often do is we blame what we do as if it were my hand's fault. I did wrong, it's my hand's fault. Couldn't help it, Lord, my hand wanted to do it. Or with my eye, Lord, I couldn't help it, my eye wanted to do it. So the Lord just takes us at our word. He says, well, you know, if you're having trouble with that ornery old hand and it just keeps getting you into trouble, cut it off. Really, Lord? Well, if the hand is really what is causing you to sin, but we all know that it's not really the hand that's causing you to sin. But the Lord says, if it's your hand that's causing you to sin, if that's the thing that's going to keep you out of heaven, it's better to cut it off, get rid of it. And if it's your eye that's causing you to sin, and you say, Lord, I can't help looking, then pluck your eyes out. The Lord leaves no excuse. I want you to turn back to Job 31 for just a moment, where Job says, I made a covenant with my eyes, because look at the motives that he possessed in doing this. And in the immediate context, we find verse 2, for what is the portion from God above and the heritage from the Almighty on high? Is it not calamity to the unrighteous and disaster to the workers of iniquity? Doth not he see my ways and number all my steps? The motives that moved Job to make a covenant with his eye that he should not lust after a maiden is fear of the divine power and respect for the divine omniscience, the all-knowingness of God. Doth he not see my ways and number all my steps? And verse 3 is the verse that talks about the fear of divine power, the judgment of God. And so Job says, I was aware of the judgment of God that comes upon the evildoer, and I was also aware of the omniscience of God, that I can't hide anything from God. I can't hide anything from Him. And so I've been aware of that as I have conducted my life. And I have conducted my life knowing that God sees my life. And I want Him to be pleased with it. Now, if you have those things, the divine power and the divine omniscience on your mind, then look at what happens. This fills the mind with a constant sense of the divine presence. And look at this idea. Forgetfulness of which is perhaps one of the most frequent causes of sin. We forget the divine presence. We forget the divine all-seeing eye watching you. We lose that God consciousness. We lose that sense of God's presence with us. You know, you think about, would it make a difference in what you did at any time in your life if your mother was with you? I think about, I really owe my mother a lot. And I disappointed her some, and I didn't enjoy that. I've tried not to do it later, since then. And if she is at my side, I'm going to be sure that I'm going to please my mother I'm not going to do anything to make her feel bad. You know, somebody who has that kind of influence on you, they make a difference if their presence is with you. Well, even if her presence is not right by my side, I still think about how is she going to react if I do this terrible thing? Well, same idea, except on a grander, infinitely grander scale. We need to have God's presence with us. How do I act when God is with me? I need to think about how I act when God is with me. So, one reason why Joseph was able to maintain his integrity was he, like Job, made a covenant with his eyes. And he had determined that there were certain things he was going to do and certain things he was not going to do. And he made it a determination so that he wouldn't have to think about what he was going to do. He would know and would react when the moment came, because he had made up his mind what he would do. Now, a second thing, he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. Now, this comes from the story of Daniel. This expression comes from the story of Daniel. But this was true in the life of Joseph also. Daniel was one of the captives taken in 605 B.C. And it wasn't very easy for Daniel either. But let me look at a point or two, and then I'll follow that up. This idea, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. Leupold, one of the outstanding commentators on Daniel, says that this purposed in his heart meant he solemnly resolved. He solemnly resolved that he would not defile himself. This decision of Daniel was made during a crisis. He was away from home and early religious associations broken. I started in a moment ago to tell you about Daniel. Here he was taken a captive. Now we are studying this period of Bible history. And I want you to think for a moment, how much righteousness was there in Judah in 605 B.C.? We've already studied enough to know there was very, very little righteousness. The Lord challenged His prophet to go and see if you could find a righteous man. Go see if you can find a righteous man. Now that's the way things were in Jerusalem where Daniel was. So the first thing I think about Daniel is there weren't many in and around Jerusalem itself, even before he went away in captivity. There weren't many in Jerusalem that wanted to do what was right. So Daniel is a very impressive figure. Even to know that he was righteous, he was a righteous man, but had grown up in the environment of Jerusalem and Judah of 605 B.C. That would have been a terrible time to live. A terrible time for anyone who's wanting to be righteous. You just have almost no encouragement to be righteous. Oh, there'd be a Jeremiah. Maybe it was Jeremiah that stirred Daniel to be faithful like he was. I don't know. The Bible doesn't show us what connection it was that made Daniel the young man he was, but he was taken as a captive far away to Babylon. And whatever support he had had back home, whatever worship he was able to do, whomever he was able to be with, he didn't have that now. And besides that, in the matter that Daniel was involved in, you see, he was taken to be one of the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, one of the eunuchs to be a servant to Nebuchadnezzar. He was given into the charge of Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they were feeding them with things, the king's dainties, the king's wine. And whatever it was, we don't know. We're not told specifically what was wrong with it, but Daniel knew enough to know that that food would defile him. Whether it was what the food was or how it was prepared, he was afraid, he was convinced that that food would defile him. There would be a temptation to regard the matter as trivial. That's one of the things that we Christians often do. We take a thing and we determine whether we ought to do it or not by whether it is up here or down here on the scale of significance. And if we want to go ahead and do it and not worry about it, one of the things we can do is take the item and shift it down in our scale of significance and make it a trivial thing that doesn't matter, and then we can do it. So you see, Daniel could have reasoned that way. He could have said, well, I don't really think it matters over here. Hear the key expression? I don't think it really matters over here in Babylon. I mean, I'm not back home. If I were back home now, I'd be really hewing the line and I'd be careful. But over here, I mean, really, it's hard to get the right kind of food, the food that is not defiled anyhow. So why even try? And another thing, see if you can identify with this. The fear of being peculiar. The fear of standing out. The fear of being peculiar. Now Joseph, likewise, would have been faced with the temptation to rationalize and say, well, it's just a trivial thing here. I mean, what does it matter? What does it matter? And if he had gone along with what Potiphar's wife was trying to get him to do, he wouldn't be making waves. He could say, I'm going to get in trouble with her if I don't do what she said. He didn't do any of that. He didn't let that deter him. Look at 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 1. After Paul has reminded us by quoting an Old Testament passage that we are to come out from among them and be ye separate and so on, in verse 1 of chapter 7, having therefore these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. And look in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 3. And everyone that hath this hope set on him purifieth himself, even as he is pure. Those who have their hope set on God, as Joseph did, purifieth himself, even as he is pure. So, Joseph made a covenant with his eyes that he should not lust. He purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself, and he fled fornication. 1 Corinthians 6:18 means to run away, to get away from. Matthew 2:13 illustrates the idea because that tells about Joseph taking Mary and the baby Jesus to get away, get out of his reach. Run away, get away from. Notice also a couple of passages here in 1 and 2 Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 11. But thou, O man of God, flee these things and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, and meekness. And then verse 22 of 2 Timothy 2. But flee youthful lust, and follow after righteousness, faith, love, peace with them that call on the Lord out of a pure heart. Flee fornication. I said to you this morning, fornication is one of those things that you don't negotiate. You flee. End of discussion. Get out of there. Get away. The last point. Joseph had also done this. He took thought beforehand for his conduct. If you wait until you're in a situation to agonize over what to do, then very likely you won't do the right thing. Think about it beforehand and know what you are going to do. In Romans chapter 12, verse 17, render to no man evil for evil. Take thought for things honorable in the sight of all men. We need to do that. We need to think about appearances. How is it going to look? I know that when I deal as a preacher with women, they want to talk about something, I always try to make sure that either it's at the house with Sandra around, or because I'm protecting your reputation and I'm protecting mine. And it's not a suspicion. It's not just some ugly suspicion. But it's that if you don't take thought for things honorable beforehand, then you leave yourself open for things to be said, and then you have no defense. Don't let that happen. Take thought for things honorable in the sight of all men. Thayer defines this idea in Romans 12, Let me read that again. Take thought. That's the verb. Now look at the definition. To provide, to think of beforehand. And Whiteside, another authority, says the Greek word for take thought in Romans 12, 17 means to pre-think, to think before you adopt a certain course of action. In Romans 13, 14, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. So, we are not to go around thinking how I can fulfill my lusts. I'm to go around thinking of how I can avoid getting into trouble because of the things that lust will cause. So these are the things that enabled Joseph to control his behavior as he did. His behavior was not an accident. It was what he thought about and what he did. Now, do you think that when you do the right thing, it'll always just make everything iron out beautifully, right there on the spot? No. It didn't with Joseph. And if you had, if you try to examine the situation right there immediately after Joseph did the right thing and he's thrown into prison and you said, Joseph, what good did it do you to do all these, you know, right things and refuse to do the wrong things? What did that get you? And Joseph might have said, well, I admit it doesn't look like it won me very much, but I believe, knowing Joseph from the story, I think Joseph would have said, I did what was right. And that was the thing that concerned him most. But you do remember how it took quite a while for things to work out. But eventually, it was to Joseph's great advantage. Even in this world, it was to his great advantage that he did the thing that was right. And very often, it is to our great advantage, even in this world, to do that which is right. But definitely in the world to come, without any qualification whatever, it is by far better to do the right thing. So let's use these great characters in the Bible. You can make a choice. There are a few in the Bible compared to the many. There were a few in the Bible, the Josephs and the Daniels, even though we can list a pretty long list of them like that, still, when you compare them with the multiplied hundreds of thousands, millions, whose names are not even given because they were going with the flow. They were running with the herd. They weren't standing out doing anything different. They were just going along with the course of evil. And you can be with them. Or you can be with a few who know that they are made in the image of God and act accordingly. So, what's it to be tonight? Are you a child of God? If you're not, right now, you're with the multitude. You're with the multitude. You are a part of the many that shall enter in at the wide gate that opens onto the broad way that leads to destruction. Jesus says, many are they that enter in thereby. Why not join the few that find the way that leads to life, that go through the narrow gate and travel the straightened way? That's the one to take because it leads to life. If you're subject to the invitation extended by Jesus, we hope you'll come as we stand and sing.